So, Rachel, you were here last week. Did you manage to do any of the homework worksheet? And did I remember to send it out?
Yeah, you did send it out,
Okay,
and
good.
I only remembered after I opened up my computer tonight. And
Yeah,
so I just
perfect.
really quickly did it while waiting for the class to go on.
Oh, okay, righty-o. You probably can have another go at it, and Wayne, if you wanted to have a go at the it was just a happiness worksheet from last week about looking at the different types of happiness, and then a gratitude journal. So, if you email the center, Wayne, I can send you the PDF of it to do. Have it settled enough to have anything become apparent about it.
No, it's definitely really good to think about. Just to see how much, like, how what I define as happiness has changed over the years. And just how much I've changed as a person and how my priorities have changed so
Yeah.
much. Yeah, I thought that was just really
So
interesting.
that is a great thing to discover because it's not you just kind of hoping that you're a better person. You can see it, and I think it should give you a lot of confidence that even though the whole time we're kind of striving, we might just think the whole time we're hopeless. But actually, you look back on this and you can see, oh no, I actually my priorities have changed. I have changed.
Yeah, and
So
I kind of feel like I have kind of this goal, I guess, of moving towards enlightenment. And I guess I kind of feel like I am kind of going in that direction, so it's good.
that's good. That's very good. And so the different types of happiness to make sure that we at least spend some of our effort on that inner resource. And then the happiness journal or the gratitude journal. So it's really nice about this practice that the practice of gratitude itself has two major benefits to it, and we're kind of going to go into a bit of that today. But one of the benefits is that if we wake up with a sense of gratitude or feeling lucky, that's the main thing that determines whether you're happy or not. It's not what's happening to you. They did this study about like people in the in a war zone in Sarajevo, and if you woke up feeling really full of gratitude that you were still there, your apartment was still there, your cat was still okay, even though the others just down the street were bombed out. That feeling of gratitude meant that those people reported feeling, a level of happiness that was much more than someone just being miserable in a perfect apartment somewhere. So even in the midst of war, just this feeling of gratitude changes everything in terms of our levels of happiness. The other thing was that when we have this sense of gratitude, which is a bit more than just feeling lucky, because it comes from a lot comes from the kindness of others, what we receive from the world, all of the support and everything that we get that we just take for granted, it brings a sense of connection. And isn't that the thing that we just are missing all the time? Have another go at it, Rachel, and keep on going, and then you'll keep on getting the benefits. What we're going to have a look at tonight, the main topic is compassion and how ordinary compassion can actually be quite short-sighted, and it can easily lead to burnout or what in our society is often called compassion fatigue. And when we're just over it. We just don't want to hear about it anymore, or we get completely burnt out and can't feel for others anymore. So we're going to have a look at how to guard against that, why that kind of thing arises, what we can do about it. And let's see how to deepen our level of compassion and what the support for it is, which in Buddhist psychology is equanimity. So Equanimity is the foundation for so many things. And there is a way that we can develop our equanimity. And then it assures that the compassion that we develop will be good and strong. It won't be biased. We won't burn out. The loving kindness that we develop won't be partial, won't lead to attachment. Love and kindness fill our heart and, you know, give us the energy to keep on going. It means that we'll be, our relationships with everybody else will be much more even and stable. You know, so all of these things depend on equanimity. So we're going to have a look at that. I'd like to start is with just a short breathing meditation. So Wayne, I might just get you to mute your microphone while we do the, you can just push that little microphone icon, just like tap on it and it mutes and unmutes if you can find the icon fairly easily. And so our 9-round breathing that we have been doing as a beginning. So let's first adjust our posture and then I'll lead you through the 9-round breathing. So our posture, striking a nice balance, an equilibrium between putting the effort into keeping our spine straight and our posture feeling fairly alert, however that is. And then relaxing our body and releasing the tension from the neck and the shoulders. So your spine straight, strong like a pillar, one stone upon the other, each supporting the one above like a pile of coins, each one supporting the one above it. So that is what holds us upright. And then we can afford to relax. Take a couple of deep breaths and bring your focus inwards. Just become aware of the rising and falling of the breath and not getting involved in whatever's happening around you, the outside things. Just focusing on that physical sensation of the breath entering and leaving the nostrils. And now that we've changed our focus and our direction to be inward, the 9-round breathing done in imagination. So first off, we imagine we're breathing out through our left nostril and in through our right nostril. As we breathe out, imagine that you're breathing out all of the afflictive emotions and doubts and worries and disturbances in the form of black smoke and the great relief of breathing that out. As you breathe in through the right nostril, imagine that you're breathing in and absorbing blissful golden light that enters into you and absorbs into you, illuminates your body. And as it does, you absorb all of the enlightening qualities, all the things you wish to develop: love, kindness, compassion, wisdom, understanding, tolerance, all those good qualities. Breathe them in the form of golden light. So 3 long, leisurely breaths out through the left nostril, in through the right. And then when you're ready, swapping the nostrils over, and this time breathing out through the right nostril, all the disturbances, the anxieties, the worries, the negative emotions that overwhelm us. That toxicity leaves you in the form of black smoke. As you breathe in through the left nostril, blissful, energizing light flows through you and you absorb all of the good qualities. So 3 times again, long, leisurely breaths. And then for the final three breaths, breathing out through both nostrils, in through both nostrils. As you breathe out, even the very fine vestiges of negativities are breathed out. The smoke becomes thinner as the negativities, the more subtle ones, are breathed out. The inner saboteurs, the doubts, the procrastination, all of those you expel in the form of black smoke. And breathing in through both nostrils, fully absorbing all of the enlightened qualities that become part of you, your body radiant and energized. So three times through both nostrils. And once you've completed the nine rounds, then for a few moments, enjoying breathing in and out, just that radiant clarity, your whole body radiant and energized, filled with light and energy. Outside of you, all clear and light, and you're breathing in and out that radiant clarity. And just let your focus rest there on the in and out. Just a very fine membrane separating the two. Not letting anything else distract you, leaving everything else in the periphery, just having your focus gently, firmly on this. And then from this sense of spaciousness and clarity, then we can adjust our motivation, our reason, our purpose for being here tonight. So starting where we are, starting with whatever it was that brought us here tonight, that's a good enough reason to start with because we acted on it. And then expanding our reason to become altruistic, to incorporate how if we ourselves benefit, then we can benefit others, how the way that we wish to be able to benefit others, to have no limit, to be the best possible benefit. May this benefit flow on to all living beings, humans, animals, the environment, the climate, the world. And then we have the verse from Lama Yeshe that is such a nice motivation. What is the purpose of being alive today? It must be something more important than drinking coffee. Today, I'll develop bodhicitta, leading to the peaceful path of liberation and full awakening for the benefit of all beings. From this moment on until I go to sleep, I shall stay aware of every action of my body, speech, and mind. Wherever possible, I shall try to help, and at the very least, I will not harm. And then with our motivation well and truly focused to get the very most out of this class and also to be able to contribute, pay back the very most, pay it forward, let's dive into our topic, starting with what's compassion? So generally, in a common everyday sense, compassion, the general definition, also from a Buddhist point of view, is a virtuous mind that wishes others to be free from suffering. So it's really nice and simple, isn't it? Love wishing others to be happy. So we talked about that a little bit last week. And then on the other side of things, this week, compassion with wishing others to be free of their sufferings. You know, we wish people to be happy. What's stopping them being happy? All of their problems and sufferings and everything that arises. And then we wish them to be free of it. So this is the kind of compassion that's for us ordinary everyday beings, for the hearers and solitary realizers of the Pali tradition, you know, the individual vehicle. So even though it's a very simple definition, isn't it? The wish for others to be free of suffering. Generally, what that depends on is us seeing suffering. And like in that photo, it's just pretty obvious suffering, obvious torment. And so if we don't see suffering, then we're not reminded to generate or cultivate a sense of compassion in our heart. And then sometimes when we do see suffering, we're so overwhelmed by it, we just shut down. And then we don't get a chance to develop compassion either. So it really became apparent to me actually at the start of COVID, when COVID happened. I mean, I know we've all tried to blank that time out of our minds, but it is worth going back now and looking back in time to when how it's only when we ourselves experience some kind of suffering that we actually even notice it in others. So, you know, when COVID happened, and for a whole lot of people, it was the first time that people lost their liberty, you know, lockdown. And that was so confronting. And people saying, no one should be made to live like this. And then it just takes a few steps to think, but there are heaps of people that do. There's the refugees, there's those incarcerated, there's, you know, those that are housebound. And they've been there the whole time. And I didn't think about them once until it happened to me. And then I went, oh my God, this shouldn't happen. And so then suddenly now I feel for those people because it's happened to me. I can feel for them, regardless of whether I'd like them personality-wise, whether we'd have the same taste in food or music. I wouldn't. You know how sometimes when people experience a really terrible suffering, they say, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Like, was that terrible? I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. So this is kind of one of the benefits of actually having problems or suffering, is that it's only through that we can cultivate any sense of compassion. So there's that great movie with, I think it's called The Doctor, with William Hurt in it, that I mentioned in the first class of this course, of a doctor that had never actually experienced suffering and or, you know, overt suffering or illness like that. Also Oliver Sacks, he wrote, you know, the great neurologist, he wrote a book quite later on in his life called A Leg to Stand On, because he broke his leg in a skiing accident in his 40s, and it was the first time he'd ever been sick. First time he'd been through the hospital system. The whole time he'd been working in the hospital system, it was the first time he'd been a patient. And he said it opened his eyes to what it was like. And it changed his whole view of patients and treating people. And if we think about it, if we're going to a doctor and we get terrible migraines and they've never had a migraine, are they going to feel for us, or are they going to say, oh, come on, it can't be that bad? If they've had a migraine themselves, then we know they understand, and we have, you know, a bit more confidence that they can help us. So in the same thing, like when COVID and the lockdowns happened, there was a whole lot of messaging about we're all in this together, to help kind of go from that initial shock of losing our liberty to recognizing we're all losing our liberty. And so then we suddenly now we feel this thing in common, this connection with everybody. And that was the way to keep society together, to keep us connected. And it's like this all the time. But when we aren't physically deprived of our liberty, we don't think about it like that. We don't think about the suffering. And yet it was a great way to be able to open our hearts to others. So how are you going so far? Any questions or comments about this? Anything's come up?
I noticed that it also created a lot more awareness about mental health. A lot more people are, aware about mental health issues now because of COVID, because I guess some people had some sort of struggle with their mental health because of the loss of liberty, like you said.
Yeah, actually, that's right. So, yes, being forced to live with yourself with very little distractions, you know, you couldn't go out and get all the food and the whatever. I mean, and if you didn't have a garden, you couldn't, you know, all of these things, you couldn't get out and distract yourself. Mm-hmm. And so then, yeah, faced with the bare face of your innate mind, boom. the mental health issues went through the roof because just the circumstances changed. And so then people saw, if just these circumstances and I lose my mind and my happiness just dissolves, I'm so miserable. You know, all those people that I think were different from me, the crazy people, not me. You know, they're different somehow. They were born different. Well, some might be neurologically wired different, but a whole lot. It's not their fault. It's the circumstances that they've experienced have been so much worse than mine. Of course, they're reacting like that. Yes. So, a lot more tolerance for mental health issues now. A lot less stigma as well. When we're seeking to cultivate our compassion, there's a couple of dangers that just in a general way that we can fall into. So one of them is that we get overwhelmed by the apparent suffering and shut down. And that's, you know, called the compassion burnout. The other one is that because we haven't got our equanimity developed well, then as we develop our compassion, it becomes very biased. And so we might have real heartfelt care and concern for the victims. And at the same time, what's developing is hatred in our heart for the perpetrators. And that is what tears society apart, that partiality, the goodies and the baddies, and the intolerance for others. So what happens there is with the baddies, the bullies, the perpetrators of, you know, crimes and everything, what we see isn't suffering. What we see is all of their anger and negativity and their destructive actions. And that's what's on the surface. And so because that's what we're seeing, we never get to the compassion bit because we can't even see the suffering. Like if you see an angry person yelling at you, your automatic response is to protect yourself or to get angry back. I mean, that's our instinctual thing. It's very rare that you see an angry person yelling at you and you immediately see the suffering behind it that's driving them to it. That's just not apparent to us. So our compassion's really beholden to recognizing suffering. And when someone's screaming it out in our face, we're not recognizing suffering. We're just recognizing the top layer. And so because of that, then we just recognize the destructive part of it, and then we think it's the person is bad, and then we respond accordingly and create more negativity, more destruction, more aggression, and so it goes on. So we can guard against both of those two things and we can figure it out tonight. So let's do the first one, guarding against burnout. Because, the compassion, the wish for others to be free of suffering, it's a lot more than a feeling. And generally it starts off as a feeling and we just leave it there, and that's why we get into trouble. So there is a difference between empathy and compassion. And in our culture, we mix the two up. We completely think, we think they're the same, and actually they're very different. So compassion's actually a conclusion and it's a reasoned, mature response. empathy is the beginning of it. But if we just leave it at empathy, we'll become overloaded. And so many empaths, as they're called, helpers, carers, get, you know, they've got big heart, and then get completely overwhelmed and burn out. And it's really a tragedy, because there's so much potential there. But so what happens? So first off, let's have a look what empathy is. And actually, there are two types of empathy. And so Corey Jackson's in his Cultivating Emotional Balance courses, he's the one that's pointed this all out, that even when the newspapers talk about empathy, when we talk about empathy, we just think it's one thing and we think it's a feeling, but actually there are two types and they're very different. So the first one, affective empathy, is where you feel for others. So where you kind of mirror the state of the, you know, the obvious suffering. So if someone's crying, you kind of tear up. You know, at weddings, you know, someone cries and then everybody starts crying. Another example of affective empathy is if you're at a party and everyone's drunk and someone starts hurling, starts like about to vomit, you get a bit vomitous. Or if you're in a plane and someone the next to you in the seat's like, whoa, just you also, you can't help it. Physiologically, you have this mirror response and you also, so then ends up everybody's vomiting. So this is the affective empathy where we feel for the other. Cognitive empathy is where it comes through reasoning, where you put yourself in their shoes and you think it through. So you understand it. You understand what's happening, but you don't feel it. So who's very good at this is doctors, surgeons, you know, because if you go to the doctors, you go, oh, I'm feeling really nauseous. I think I'm going to chuck up. I've got this terrible, you know, food poisoning or whatever it is. And then you get really sick at the doctors. And then the doctor starts vomiting too. Like, we've been in terrible trouble. So what a doctor has to cultivate is cognitive empathy. They have to understand what's happening to you and yet not be moved by it so that they can keep their head and help you. Parents as well need this. They need to have cognitive empathy so they can put themselves in their child's shoes when they're having a tantrum or when they're inconsolable, crying, I lost my teddy, whatever it is, they can understand and know the right thing to say to console. But if when the kitty loses the teddy and it's just the worst thing ever, and then the parent also breaks down and cries and God, it's the end of the world, we'll never be happy again, that's no good either. So parents, you know, are skilled at this. Corey also pointed out quite shockingly that torturers are very skilled at this too, cognitive empathy. This is how come torturers know the exact thing to do to be able to make someone suffer, because they can reason it out, they can put themselves in their shoes and they don't feel it. So they know the buttons to push, the exact where the fear is. They hone in on it. Very, very smart. They're not overwhelmed. They're not even moved by the suffering of the other person. So there's these two types of empathy right there that are going on, and we need to employ both of them. So before we go on, do you have any questions or comments about this? Can you recognize the difference between the two types of empathy? How are you going there, Wayne? Does it ring any bells?
Yep, absolutely.
Good. Good, good. Any questions or comments? Any other examples come to mind?
No, I'm a bit quiet tonight.
Oh, okay. No worries. Go for it.
In a workplace, when you've got like an over-demanding boss, and it's very easy to not realise their struggle as well.
Ah, yes.
Because they're under the pump, and it's like it just come. It's so easy to just see it as an attack.
Yep.
But
yeah, And
one way to keep calm in the situation is to have that understanding that they're going through what you're going through as well.
Yes. Yeah, so that's right. But it takes effort to kind of remind yourself, oh, hang on a second. So you have the cognitive, you can develop the cognitive empathy. Oh, yeah, just like they're pressuring me, probably they're getting pressured an equal amount, if not worse. So then you may not at first feel warmly towards them or feel concern, but it stops us taking it personally. It stops the aggression. It stops us feeling negative back again at the very least. And then we can actually work on going, well, gee whiz, I feel pretty bad, but, you know, I'm just a lowly worker. I can do something about it. They're stuck. They're hammered from everywhere. Their boss hates them and their workers hate them. So, yeah, really good example. So we have both of those types of empathy. Also, affective empathy. This is the one that we can see, that if we just see suffering and we recognize it and we feel it, we feel others suffering over and over and over again, of course we burn out. But as Corey Jackson's also pointed out, that's not compassion fatigue. Actually, it's empathy fatigue. And if we could recognize it for what it actually is, empathy fatigue, it gives us a way of dealing with it. So when we're developing our compassion, which you can't get fatigued about, you can't burn out from compassion, what we need to do is use our existing feelings, your heart opening to others, your instinctual concern, and then you expand that warm-hearted concern out using your reasoning and logic. So we have, you know, the little lambies going to the slaughter. We have the poor kid that's lost their teddy bear. We have our fellow worker that's in tears from being pressured. And then we use our logic to expand it out to have an equal sense of concern for everybody, including the perpetrator. Not in a kind of denial way, but by actually just recognizing that they too are suffering, but their suffering isn't apparent, so I haven't got that effective empathy for them yet. But once we think it through, then we do. So just, you know, like you're saying, oh yeah, that's right, they're probably under the pump too. So then once we remind ourselves with that, so that takes some effort on our part, then after a while it becomes habitual. So for parents, it becomes habitual. When they're raising children, it's habitual to put themselves in the child's shoe all the time to try and raise them up well. Teachers, it becomes habitual. Doctors who have a good bedside manner, it's become habitual. And so eventually we can expand it out to include everybody, all living beings. So we have this equal concern, whether the suffering is apparent, whether it's hidden, because we're getting underneath to this kind of universal, zeitgeist of how we're all undergoing some kind of suffering, whether I can see it in you or not. We all have things that hurt us and things we're worried about. We're all miserable when we get the flu, in that respect, then we can have that, we use our cognitive empathy to cultivate a sense of compassion. But we're not there yet, because what comes next is compassion, which is an activity. It's a wish. Oh, I wish they were free of suffering. So it's got within it, it's not just, oh, poor thing, pity. Compassion goes, I wish I could help you. I wish you were free of this. And so within it is this urge to act and a sense of taking responsibility. Somebody's got to do something. you know, it's got to be me. Or that feeling, I wish I could do something. And so then you're primed to help in whatever way that you can. So with this, when it becomes an activity, so an activity, not just a feeling, we turn it into an activity. I wish they were free of suffering. Then we have somewhere to go with all of that emotion. We can use it. And we can harness all of our reasoning as well to keep us on track. So when we have this sense of activity or action that we're ready to do something, or we just do whatever we can, immediately we get our sense of agency back. We get our power back, and that stops us being burnt out. While empathy alone, it can be very, very exhausting. The thing then about how compassion becomes an activity is that the activity isn't all about the suffering. It's about wishing to help. So that gives us energy, and it's not depressing. So, for example, then, if we expand it out to include everybody, then we get what's called great compassion. And so that is a virtuous mind that wishes to protect all living beings from their suffering. So it's gone from just seeing some suffering and wishing they were free of it to this just natural state of being to protect others from their suffering. So what's different here is that it's an attitude. And what happens to us is that we kind of forget that compassion is an attitude in us, and we get very goals or result focused, and we think, I've got to do the thing, I've got to help that person. And then if one day we can't help them, then we feel we've failed. So this is why first responders burn out, because they have this, you know, big-heartedness to help others. And when they can, it makes them happy. And then one time where they can't save the person, or they're stuck in traffic and they don't get there on time and they can't help, it's devastating. And it's because the compassion is focused on the, you know, the goal-oriented being able to help that person, rather than on keeping this attitude strong. Wherever possible, I'm going to help. And at the very least, I'm not going to harm. So because it becomes outward focused, then when outwardly we can't help, then it's devastating. And so what first responders are taught to do is to shut down, to not take it personally, let it go. And so all of the general response to that, even, you know, there's no training, there's nothing, is to just harden your heart so it doesn't make you feel devastated. And so then you shut down from that, and then you go and you have a few other experiences where you can help people and you start feeling better again. But if you have enough times where you haven't been able to help, where there has been a disaster and you haven't been able to achieve that goal, and you shut down, then you shut down forever. You lose your ability to feel and care for others, and that's burnout. And that is a terrible tragedy, isn't it? Especially for first responders that are made to, you know, they're just like, that's all they want to do is help, and then they just can no longer do it ever again, and their nervous system's blown up, and they just don't want to know about anybody else's problems ever again because it's too much, they're burnt out. And it's because it becomes that external goal oriented, and we forget there's a step before that, which is the attitude of wishing to help. And then if I can, fantastic, that's an added bonus. And if I can't, I'm still going to keep that attitude in my heart. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, compassion can sometimes manifest as external activities, but it is always an internal activity. So it's always an attitude. So then we're in a state of readiness whenever, you know, something, you know, some situation presents itself. And personally, I think that the few times that I've been able to actually try and develop this state of mind has made a big difference between, you know, something happens out in the supermarket or something, you don't have all of that shyness and social inertia, or should I do something or not? You just much more spontaneously go to help. So often I'll see on the bus to the supermarket, single mums will get on with their prams and their bags and their screaming kids or their whatever, and they're like struggling with everything. And it's other mums or grandmothers that recognise this, and they just stand up and help. You know, they don't know each other. They don't care if everybody's looking at them, which the whole bus is. The whole bus is mesmerised by what's going on, but they're not self-conscious because they understand and they're ready to help. It's deep within them. So I noticed the first time was because I couldn't do that. So I was sitting in the food court at the supermarket, and it was boiling hot day, and I just bought this really nice ice cream, and I hadn't. Oh, and I'd eaten it, and it was really fantastic. And so I was just still sitting there enjoying my, you know, little break. And I watched this lady at the ice cream shop getting a very similar ice cream, but hers was triple decker, and she was clearly looking forward to this ice cream. And she went to the table to sit down, and the whole thing just toppled off the ice cream cone onto the floor, splat. And like her face, she was just, it was just like the straw that broke the camel's back. But it must have been a hard day, and she'd done that to cheer herself up, and that was it. She was just so devastated. So I was mesmerized watching this, but I was also kind of frozen. I didn't think of anything to do, and I was a little bit far away, and there's all the people all around, and like, you know, if nobody else moves, then nobody else moves. And so then eventually she went and she got a serviette from the ice cream shop, who didn't even come out to help, and cleaned it up herself. And so I really felt for her, but I didn't do anything. I was just overwhelmed by inertia. And then by the time she left, then I kind of relaxed. And then I looked, and in my shopping, I just bought these fake flowers. And I just thought, oh, I'm such an idiot. I should have just raced up and given her my bunch of fake flowers to cheer her up. And like, why didn't I think of that at the time? I had everything there to be able to help, just like our motivation. I'll always try and help, and if I can't, then at least I won't harm. But because I hadn't been primed, I'd just been overwhelmed by social inertia. So that is just stuck with me. I so wish I had just done that one simple thing, and I'm sure it would have helped. So after that, then I thought, we have to be ready. We can't just rely on the situation. Oh, you see someone going through a little microcosm of a disaster, and, oh, yeah, I'm a good person, I'll naturally help and be compassionate, because we don't. It's bystander syndrome. We just stand back, and unless somebody else moves first, nobody moves. So how do we get over that? It's by having primed ourselves beforehand, by cultivating the attitude of compassion, the attitude of wherever I can, I'm going to try and help. And so then it just would have come naturally to me. I would have gone, oh, I've got a tissue, I can help you clean up, and here's a bunch of flowers to brighten your day. So, I mean, this was like years ago now, and it's still so raw because I got it so wrong. So bystander syndrome, have you heard of that? Do you know? It's that thing where if you say in a small town, and you know, where everyone knows each other, and someone's fallen down on the main street, people just naturally run up to that person to see if they're okay, because it's a really small community and there's only a few people around. But the more people there are around, the less likely anyone is to help, until you get into a big city in the CBD and a little old lady has a heart attack and falls over, and everybody just looks around and goes, oh, well, nobody else is doing anything, so I won't. It's too embarrassing. And then we justify it by going, oh, they're probably drunk, it's their own fault, or they're homeless or whatever, or I'd never let myself go like that, and justify it away. And then later on you find out this poor sweet little old lady, she fell over, she had a heart attack and she died because nobody helped. The more people that walk past, the more everybody else is going to walk past. It's such an indictment on our society. But I've noticed that happening in my own life.
Yeah, I think they've literally done studies on these. And like you said, the more people there are, the more people are scared to stick out, maybe to be outside the norm. I don't know. It's a weird psychological thing.
It's a psychological thing. And also because we just have that concern if it appears before us, we're not going around with that concern there as an attitude in our heart the whole time. And so then if the situation appears before us and at the same time everybody else is appearing before us not doing anything, it cancels each other out.
And does it have to do with like our concern for ourselves outweighs our concern for the other person?
On a deep level, it's that real deep egocentricity, but it's not even the most coarse levels of self-concern, because many people do have that I wonder if they're okay. But then the social pressure comes on, and that is the egotism. And so the only thing that cuts through that is if you've already worked it out, you've already primed your mind, and you've got that altruistic thing of, instead of feeling it's social pressure, like, you know, you're saying, Rachel, that you, you're already thinking of others. So you're thinking of the bystanders and the person who's fallen down and the first responders. You're thinking of everybody, so it's not a problem.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, that's true, actually, because, yeah, if it was a first responder there, they're like, this is my job, and we'll just go for it. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Because they're already primed. This is my job.
Yeah.
So that's what we've got to do. Compassion, this is my job. And so compassion, not a feeling, but this attitude to help, to spontaneously wish people were free of suffering, then we'd at least try and help them up. Then we've got to try and develop how we do this, you know, trying to develop great compassion. And so that's, you know, we start with where the feeling is elicited from, great suffering, someone experiencing torment. And then we move to the person who's dear to us, and we also think, oh, you know, my friends, my family, I wish they were free of suffering. And that's really easy to do. And then we move to neutral people that we don't necessarily feel anything about. And then finally we move out this sense of compassion and wishing to help to our enemies as well. And how we do all of this is because we recognize everybody suffers the same. You know, we feel pain, we're scared of the dark, we don't want family problems, all of this, we all, you know, we're the same that way. And first responders, they all know this, don't they? They all know everybody suffers. They're not worried if someone's rich or poor, if they like them or not. They have that real understanding. This leads us to the equanimity part. So equanimity, we looked at compassion. We looked at great compassion, that is a wish to protect others from suffering. So it has this feeling of, you know, this one, protect all living beings from suffering. It has this feeling of responsibility for others' welfare. And it's a feeling that is for all living beings, not just for one section that appears nice or that we like or that seems to be suffering, but for everybody. So we're looking beneath the appearances. And how we do that is by developing equanimity. So equanimity, if we don't have it, then even if we have compassion, it's going to lead to conflict. And this is how wars start, because, you know, soldiers will go and they will actually give up their life for their country. They want to free their country from oppression. They want to protect their family. So they have these very strong feelings, but it's partial. It's just for me and mine. And at the same time, there's hatred for the enemy, and there's dehumanizing the enemy, calling them names, giving them numbers, denigrating them so that they feel more and more other until they feel like they're not even human. And then you go to war. So, and then often so very many social justice advocates and people work for like the rights of animals and things like that. They have huge compassion for the animals and huge hatred for the perpetrators. So again, hatred is an attitude in our heart. And what does it do? It's like a toxic cancer that eats us up, and it creates unhappiness for ourselves and others. And there is another way to respond to this with equanimity. So because equanimity is about recognizing how we're all the same living beings, not wanting suffering and wanting happiness, it's not about their activities. It's not having equanimity about their activities. Everything that everybody does is the same. The perpetrators are still doing terrible things. That's never in doubt. But we, as we've heard so many times, we mix up the person and their behavior and we think they're the same thing. And so with this partiality, then our compassion can lead to war, conflict, and more aggression. So let's have a look at the different types of equanimity. So from the Buddhist psychology side of things, we have a small scope. Equanimity is when we look out at the sentient beings and we just wish they could live peacefully together, that they were free of their afflictions, that they were free of resentment and hatred and aggression, and they're free of partiality and just caring about their own family, not caring about their neighbors. And it's a little bit like, you know, Lenin's Imagine All the People. So we can all relate to this one. If everybody... And this is a lot to do with just our actions. So even though in our mind we might be, you know, quite partial, we still treat others with respect. And if everybody did that, if everybody just refrained from being aggressive, for instance, the whole world would be at peace. So it's a powerful one, but from a Buddhist psychology point of view, this is a small scope. We have middle scope, and that's where from our side we overcome our bias, our attachment for friends, dislike of enemies, and just kind of blankness about strangers. So from our side we change that relationship and we have much more equilibrium. And so for instance, first responders are kind of trained in this in a way, in that whether someone comes in and they're all smelly and homeless and dirty because they don't have a house to have a wash, or whether they come in because they're drunk or they're off their head on ice and they're being really angry and belligerent, whether they come in and they're really sweet and kind and cracking jokes even though they're in pain, or whether they come in and they're rich and arrogant and telling everybody what to do, first responders just go, under the skin, we're all the same. And we expect them to have that kind of equanimity, to be impartial. We just think, well, that's their job. Actually, it's quite a big thing to be able to overcome our aversion towards others or our attraction towards others and be impartial. But it's very doable, isn't it? Then the great scope, equanimity. This is actually where we overcome that favoritism between you and I. So we see, just like I suffer, so does everybody else. There is no difference. So there's a band. There's a band called You Am I. That's based on this. You Am I. Because we see that in terms of wishing to be free from suffering, and in terms of wanting happiness, we are the same. We're, in fact, interchangeable. And so why should I care more for my welfare than yours? There's no reason. So that's the equanimity. We balance out self and other, and that's really quite profound. And so in practice, it actually means that we put others first, because me, I'm just one, but others are many. So how could I put my welfare in opposition or before others? So what do you have questions about these three different types of equanimity?
The two definitions for middle scope and great scope, it kind of sounds the same to me.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah. The middle scope is where I'm here and I've got all the different types of people and I feel differently towards all those people. I care about my friends. I don't care about the strangers. And I'm pretty happy when my enemies suffer. So it's the relationship that I have and I, the way I value people is pretty much by how they treat me. So we're trying to even that out and go, well, even if they're yelling at me, I'm going to reduce my anger. And even if they're nice to me, I'm not going to be partial towards them. But it's to do with our relationship with others like that and how it's so extreme. And it's so divisive and bias, partiality. And so this is the one where countries will do a lot for their own people and nothing for the people next door. So an example of this is, say, you know, when Russia invaded Ukraine and, you know, Chernobyl, it's in Ukraine. And so the Russian army took over the Chernobyl area, said, well, it's ours now. And because it was in Ukraine, they didn't care about the Ukrainian people. But in the process of that, when they took it over, all of the safety mechanisms just went out the window. So, you know, everybody suffered. But because we're so used to thinking me and mine, my people, and they matter, and those people over there, they don't matter. I think the best one just comes back to first responders, kindergarten teachers. So I like this example because I don't particularly like toddlers. And I, you know, I don't dislike them, but I find it very difficult to get on with them. But a kindergarten teacher, whether there's a toddler that is acting out or whether there's a toddler that's sweet as pie, whether there's one that's just asleep so there's no problem. A kindergarten teacher has a duty of care to all of them and has to look after all of them equally, regardless of how they personally feel about them.
But how is that different from great scope?
The great scope is where it's between me and the others. So the others are all equal already now. And then what comes first, my benefit or the others' benefit? Whereas middle scope just evens out the others from up and down.
Oh.
Great scope is now others who are all even, who are all equally important. Now it's others and me who's more important.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
I know it's quite a it took me ages to get my head around this, and actually until Eddie spelled it out in the How to Develop Bodhicitta course, Discovering Buddhism, I never even knew there was a difference. Because when you hear the teachings on equanimity, they're all mushed in together, and most of them are this middle scope one of evening out friend, enemy, stranger, evening out our favoritism. But actually, the Mahayana, the great scope, the altruistic intention, that is evening out me and others. And who comes first?
The others. Because there's
many others.
Yeah.
And that's radical.
But that's very like advanced. So I guess we're kind of like just focus on this.
Yeah, but we work up to it, because there's all those hypotheticals that people go through. You know, if you And like, so I watch those shows, what is it, airline disasters, you know, and then they, many of those stories when the aircraft crashes in an extreme situation like that where things are very obvious, the suffering is obvious, people will go back into the plane to pull others out.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not thinking, oh, can I do it or not? Their attitude is, I'm going to try and help. They're not thinking, what are the odds that I'll be able to get them out? Or, yeah, I don't know if I'm the right person to do it, or not quite ready, maybe some other time. Like all of these things that we have, they just like, they can see the need and there's all the people there and here I am out here. Who's more important? The suffering people. And off they, and they, and it is instinctual. So, I mean, that really shows that that those good qualities, they're at the core of our nature. And when situations are pretty unequivocal like that, and, you know, if we're not hampered by our own disturbing emotions that's blocking us, if we're just in a neutral state, ordinary people will do extraordinary things. So that's the beginning there of what we can cultivate into great compassion that becomes like a lifestyle and attitude. Who comes first? And, I mean, parents do it, who comes first, self or other, when the child isn't sleeping and the parent just goes, oh, well, I'll give up my sleep for the child. But it's not, doesn't come from the middle scope basis of equanimity there. So they'll only do it for their child, but they wouldn't do it for their neighbor's child. So in the types of equanimity, there is a progression there. One builds on the other. And then that way, even when we do put others, you know, with the great scope, if we put others first before ourselves, it's impartial. It's all others. It's not just my family and stuff, the rest of them. So then there's this really interesting thing called the enemies of equanimity, the near enemy and the far enemy. And I thought, oh, this is such an interesting term, the near enemy and far enemy. Just really piqued my curiosity. So the near enemy of equanimity and the far enemy. The far enemy are the obvious ones. Anger and malice will hinder us having equanimity. Jealousy hinders us having equanimity. Partiality and prejudice. Cruelty, attraction, repulsion, all of those things, like they're the up and down things and they're really easy to spot. They hinder our equanimity. But if we haven't trained in developing equanimity, there are the near ones. And so they look like being equanimous, but we're not. It looks like we're impartial, but we're not. So these are interesting. Indifference, just a feeling of indifference. So it's even, it has an even regard for everybody, but it's not even open-heartedness or even concern, it's even indifference. It's evenly ignoring everybody. So that's not the equanimity we're trying to develop, that just zoned out equanimity. It will certainly mean that there's not that much aggression. So based on worldly life, yeah, it's better than aggression, but there's nothing positive or virtuous in it. Apathy is another one. So when we have apathy, we don't have that sense of concern in our heart. We're kind of shutting down, aren't we? And we see something and we just go, oh, whatever. Oh, change the channel. I want to watch comedy. Or, oh, that's actually more indifference. No, apathy is where we don't have the energy to do something. And so we go, oh, yeah, they're all suffering, but they're over there in another country. They're the other side of the world, whatever. And then generally Like with the bushfires. If I hear about bushfires overseas, I go, oh, where are they? Oh, Greece, California, whatever. It's over there. It doesn't matter. It's not me. But then you hear about bushfires, even say just in Canberra, or bushfires in northern New South Wales, bushfires coming into towns where people I know are. And now suddenly there's less apathy. So apathy, again, it's not equanimity. It's not that evenness that we're trying to develop. It's actually a not caring. It's actually like the, it looks similar, but it's not. So the far enemy, they're clearly the opposite of equanimity and compassion and kindness. There's no ambiguity there. But the near enemy, it looks really similar, and we feel it as fairly similar because we're not in an extremity of emotion. And so we think we're just being even, and that's a good thing. But actually, on the inside, they're their opposite, because apathy is the opposite of this urge to help or a readiness to help. And because they feel fairly even, we can either be unaware that it's not the equanimity we're trying to develop, or we just, you know, coast along and don't seek to cultivate those good qualities while everybody else is still suffering. And so this is what happened then when COVID hit, like we're talking about earlier in the class. So many of us were in this sense of indifference. And so we thought we were good people because we didn't hate everybody and we weren't aggressive. But actually what we were indifferent to everybody. Until lockdown happened and we lost our liberty, and now suddenly our indifference evaporated. So I find these quite confronting, looking at the near enemy. And then the other one, not noticing the faults or the qualities of others. So we don't have huge averse reactions to somebody because we just don't notice their faults, or we don't have huge liking or attraction to someone because we just don't notice their qualities. So we're just kind of blah about everybody. And so we have a fairly even mind. But again, there's no richness there. There's no heart there. So questions or comments about this, the near and far enemies? How are you going?
So what do you think the reasons are for not noticing people's faults or qualities?
Just because, like, the only incentive that we have to have compassion arise is when we see suffering. We've just left it at that. So we're just coasting along. We haven't trained in it. So it's not like we've done anything wrong. It's just that's kind of the default. The baseline's not very good. We just coast along, and it's only if there's a crying kitten that we feel compassion. But until then, we're just not even noticing that everybody's got their thing going on. And just through that indifference or not noticing, so much harm happens, doesn't it? You know, then we just run roughshod over people because we forget they might be having a sensitive day. So many hidden disabilities. We think, oh, like if someone isn't in a wheelchair, we think they're fine and they should be acting better. But how do we know they're not recovering from trauma, or someone hasn't just died, or they're having a mental health episode? How do we know any of these things? How do we know they're not illiterate and they can't read the sign? We just think they should have been more polite. So it's just through not training ourselves. So this is what His Holiness the Dalai Lama says about near enemies. Okay, so near enemies are hard to detect. The near enemy of love is attachment, because both emotions see the good qualities in the other person. However, attachment clings to others with unrealistic expectations. And the affection that we feel is polluted with possessiveness and neediness. Compassion's near enemy is personal distress. So this grief is based on worldly life and is the sadness felt when our dear ones are unhappy. It's similar to compassion in that both have an element of sorrow due to others' misery. But again, you know, it's partial, isn't it? The near enemy of joy is happiness based on worldly life. So this is relating to what we talked about last week, you know, delight at receiving sense pleasures or status, just, you know, enjoying good food, good music, all of that kind of delight. And we kind of think that's happiness, but actually it's just the what's coming in through the senses, and it's very flighty. Giddy with excitement, we become too involved and attached to someone else's happiness. Equanimity's near enemy is indifference and apathy based on worldly life. They're similar to equanimity in that they don't notice the faults or the good qualities of others. So we just don't notice. And because we're not noticing, we're not going to extremes, so we're not creating overt harm, but we might indirectly or accidentally harm. So that's from this great book, Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions, really by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Chodron, a Western nun. And this book, if you want a book to start off with Buddhism, this is the one. It's fantastic. Really written for a Western audience, but authentic Buddhism.
Can I write that down?
Yes, or take a photo. You can't because... Yeah, so Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions. If you just kind of Google that, it'll come up with all the rest of the details. So
yeah, got it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
In the bit of time that we have left, I thought we could just have dive a little bit into that middle scope level of equanimity of how to actually develop it. Because that's pretty much where most of us are, and it's the most practical one for us to develop because, you know, like you said, Rachel, the great scope one of exchanging oneself with others, that's already an advanced practice. And to be able to do that, we have to have already had an evenness of mind of no partiality. So it's kind of good to just backtrack a bit to this equal equanimity that we can develop so it becomes equal affection for all or equal concern for all. So basically we've got a strategy here, feeling equal care. So that's, you know, affection and concern towards all. And we've got the three categories. So feeling, we normally feel affection to our friends, and so we take that feeling and we expand it to everybody. How to feel warmly towards strangers, we raise the bar. So we don't just leave it at indifference. We raise the bar. So this picture here of like a stranger just like meh, just whatevs, you know, that's pretty much, we don't care, we just to shrug the shoulders. But how to actually turn that into feeling warmly towards strangers. And then the harder one, feeling concern for enemies, judge the behavior, not the person. So we'll just take a moment to go into this. And so we might just actually start with this one, the feeling, the concern for enemies. So I put this picture here of a guard dog, you know, teeth bared, scary. So we do need to recognize danger, get out of the way. And, you know, just in the news, actually I read today, there was a six-year-old girl south of Brisbane that got mauled by a dog, horrendously mauled by a dog. And it happens really often, like every couple of weeks, you hear about a baby being mauled or a child being mauled by somebody's dog. And every time there's this huge uproar in the community and the dog's taken away and most of the times put down. And there are a section of people that will say it's an evil dog, but there most people will recognize that dogs are like this because either they can't help it, it's bred into them, or because they've been brutalized. So, you know, even then, like, there is this understanding that a dog's nature, and especially some breeds of dogs, is to be aggressive. So what did we think? Did we expect anything else? And especially with guard dogs that are brutalized, that are on top of that taught to be aggressive to everybody, and because they're continuously in fear. So there is a way to rehabilitate dogs. There's a whole range of fantastic videos on YouTube and DVDs of the dog whisperer, Cesar Millan, who has had incredible success in rehabilitating really aggressive dogs. And he actually gets the dogs to rehabilitate themselves, and aggressive dogs will become non-aggressive. So I find it much easier to think first about the animal world like that, because you can understand the behavior, you can see where they're coming from, you still know to keep your distance, but you don't have hatred arising in your heart, and you don't have this why kind of thing, and you don't just want to go out and kill all dogs. So this is a way that we can differentiate between the dog who is suffering and frightened and the behavior which is dangerous. And those two things are different. And if we can do that with understanding with animal world, then we transfer that to human beings.
I actually used to volunteer at the RSPCA with dogs, and there's no naturally aggressive breeds. There are more breeds that have a tendency to be loyal. And so if the owners encourage that sort of aggressive behavior, then they become more aggressive.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, that is amazing to hear, because that's like a little microcosm of the Buddhist understanding of Buddha nature.
Yeah.
You know, so no naturally aggressive breed of dog. It's like saying the mind, even the mind of a dog, is not naturally aggressive, because there's Buddha nature there. Mm-hmm. So at the core of a dog's being is that goodness, not aggression. Yeah. So that is fantastic to hear, Rachel, because there it is, positive proof.
Exactly. And like I've noticed that a lot of dogs, even though they've been hurt, they've been traumatized, if you just learn to communicate with them and like show them respect and understanding and love, a lot of them like will love and respect and show that back to you.
It's learning to communicate, and because dogs communicate differently from humans, we've got to kind of put a bit of effort into understanding what's their order of priorities, which is discipline, exercise, food, then love. Different from humans. So if we have that understanding, so now we're developing our cognitive empathy. We've got this real we've matured our sense of compassion. And so of course you're working those, you're on purpose going and volunteering with dogs and rehabilitating them. So you have this natural care and concern, even though the appearance could be quite aggressive. And then we can learn to do that with humans. The appearance is aggressive, but we have concern for what's underneath. And so, like His Holiness said, we actually start with those that we love, those close to us. And so when the toddler becomes like a little living demon and chucks a tantrum, the parent learns to go, to not take it personally. When they throw the food that they spend all those hours cooking, to not take it personally, because they're all the while training to see what's underneath. And so, yes, judge the behavior. It's terrible behavior. The toddler can't continue like that as they grow up. They have to learn. And it's the parent's job. Oh, my God, what a job to teach them. But underneath is this conviction that it's possible, because underneath, in the good circumstances, the very best of that toddler comes out. Sweet, delightful, wonderful, fresh-faced, clear being. So you have a conviction what's underneath is different, and then we can judge the behavior, not the being, not the person, and have genuine concern. So this also happens, like when someone has a mental health episode and they lose the plot and they might say terrible things to you, you know in your mind it's not them. It's their disease. It's their schizophrenia. And how can you hate them for that? Anytime we see an angry face, guaranteed underneath it is unhappiness. It never comes from happiness. It never comes from peace. It never comes from a fulfilled life. It comes from suffering. So we've got to learn to equate that. Angry face means suffering. Then with the strangers, if we just think a little bit about a person, and this is why I love being on the bus, you know, you just look around and then I start thinking, I don't know this person, so I don't feel anything for them. But if I think about, you know, I wonder if they've got a good diet, or if they've got a tummy ache. I wonder if they're, you know, I wonder what's happening in their home life, if everything's going okay. I wonder where they're going, if they're nervous about it or not. You know, I hope things go well for them. I hope they're free of suffering. And so if you think nicely about someone and think, well, you know, if they had been in my family and I knew them, I would, at this very moment, someone gets on the bus and you know them, you go, oh, hi. Are you so happy to see them? Because you know them. So if I had have just through happenstance or karma, whatever you call it, known this stranger on the bus over there for that amount of years, I would go, oh, how happy to see you. So why aren't I feeling that now? It's just a matter of time. So if you go like this, in the end, you're sitting there, you might have a silly grin on your face. Everyone thinks you're a bit nuts because you're feeling very warmly towards everybody on the bus. And then if someone drops their groceries or trips over or whatever, then you're just like, oh, here, I'll help. There's no problem. It's great. So it's a nice little experiment to try at home and on the bus to do it, to just see how it goes. So that raises the bar so that you end up feeling warmly towards others. And, of course, the benefit is you feel warmly towards everyone. You feel connected with everybody. Even you haven't talked to anybody, you don't feel lonely. You don't feel miserable. You have this sense of belonging. It has a fantastic effect on us. But and the other one, of course, those that we know and love, that we have spent the time with, that we know their backstory, they've come to matter to us, that we naturally have affection for. Also the ones that we have a close karmic connection with, so we get on, they understand us, all of those things. So we have this natural affection. We think about them and we just naturally wish them to be happy. And when and if something happens, we naturally wish to help them be free of whatever suffering or problem it is. You know, we'll help pay for their operation, or we'll drive them to the hospital, or whatever it is. So that comes because we've developed a good friendship. And so then it naturally comes. So we know how to do it. Now we just have to do it for everybody, not just the people that we like. or the people that are nice to us. Because, of course, what happens with friends, if suddenly they stop being nice to us, then they're not our friend anymore and we don't want anything to do with them. So that's the partiality where all the difficulties come. So if we actually start feeling that everybody is our friend, but just through circumstances may not be manifesting that at the moment, then we can start extending that natural love that we have and a natural affection to everybody. So that's our job, folks. It's very doable. Start the easy way. Start with that natural affection that we already have and that natural care that we already have. But we can't leave it there. We've got to develop it so that it becomes non-partisan, unbiased, no favoritism. And so the example of the first responders, school teachers, kindergarten teachers, help desk, customer care, the people on the desk at airlines, like all of that, a lot of the service industries, old people's homes, everything. We expect that level of impartiality, and not just that, but we expect an even level of care. And that's what we call professionalism. So Rinpoche, Lama Tsering Rinpoche, he talks about what we've got to develop in Buddhist psychology is becoming an inner professional, so that our attitude to all living beings has that level of equanimity, equal concern for everybody, equal care for everybody. That's becoming an inner professional. So if we expect it of others, and our society actually functions because of that, then of course we can develop it. So yeah, we've got to become an inner professional. In a way, that's what a Buddha is. So it's just past eight. Are there any questions, last questions or comments before we do our dedication? What do you reckon? Are you gonna work on this inner professionalism?
Thing about the whole professionalism is, I guess it's expected at the end of the day, you're supposed to leave that at work. You're not supposed to carry things around. But the thing is, with what we're trying to do here, we're supposed to do it around the clock.
Okay.
And it just kind of sounds exhausting.
Yes, and that's why we had to talk about empathy burnout, because a lot of that, you're right, Rachel, a lot of that external professionalism is just left at the level of empathy and not turned into compassion. So it's just the feeling to want to help others, and it becomes overwhelming and exhausting. But that's because we haven't cultivated it into compassion, which is this attitude of being ready to help. And if you can, great. And if you can't, next time. So any of the exhaustion that we feel, that's empathy burnout. So that's that side of things. And, yeah, many, many professionals do have that. And it's because it's not compassion fatigue. It's empathy burnout, because of not knowing how to translate empathy into compassion. So they're really two really crucial things, aren't they? How to have the equanimity to be professional, and how to develop the compassion so we don't burn out.
Oh gosh, okay. The two are mixed in my mind, so it's so hard for me to.
Yeah, that's right. But we got to come back again and again. And yeah. Rachel, to just realize that we do have the capacity to do it, but it won't happen by itself. It won't happen accidentally.
Yeah.
We've got to kind of do a bit of training in it, just like professionals have to do a bit of training. And there's courses on how to do it, how to deal with difficult customers and all these things. Like you have the natural wish to do so, and then you get the training how to do it. So it's the same thing. We have the capacity. We can. We have that natural wish at the core of our being, but we need the training how to do it. And so this Tammy said, let's make t-shirts, inner professional in the making. Oh, I wish I had a Buddhist t-shirt line, I tell you what, but it's we have such a small market, nobody would get it. So we'll do the dedication. Tammy, we've got one more class. So the next week will actually be on how to end our day well. Again, Rachel, this might help with not feeling tired at the end of the day instead of having that near, you know, the near enemy of equanimity, which is just indifference, shutting down, how to actually rejuvenate, like get our energy back again. And how to save the energy and dedicate the energy each day so that it doesn't get lost or corrupted, but we can continue, the momentum continues. So that's what we're looking at. You know, the beginning of the course, we started with motivation. The last class is on dedication. So with that, let's dedicate. I have the screen share. So just before we read this out together, so just think how wonderful that you have dedicated your time tonight like this, that you put in the effort and feel good about that. That's, you know, making all of these inner changes. It's hard work and not many people do it. So this is a great way to have benefited yourself and the world. And so then we can take all of this and we can focus it, dedicate it to a particular thing. So here we are. Let's read it out. Due to all the merits of the three times accumulated by me and by others, merely by seeing, hearing, remembering, touching, or talking to me, may any being be freed in that very second from all their sufferings, diseases, spirit harms, negative karmas, and obscurations, and abide in the peerless happiness of full enlightenment forever. So we send all the energy off in this direction, and then that way the momentum will keep on going until this comes to pass.